Customized websites with the Wix website builder at wix.com.
This is the Daily Circuit. Good morning. I'm Tom Weber, along with Mark Sedeklik. Mark, I had a lot of fun out at the Fitzgerald Theater this week. We had John Grotzinger from NASA's
Full House, too, right?
Full House, Science Night, Minnesota. You're going to hear that conversation coming up this hour.
First, a look at regional news. St. Paul Mayor Chris Coleman says part of Lilydale Regional Park will be closed indefinitely because of the rock slide that killed two fourth graders hunting for fossils during a field trip on Wednesday. Minnesota Governor Mark Dayton attended a memorial for the two boys this morning at Peter Hobart Elementary School in St. Louis Park. Some Minnesotans will be paying the new income tax on top earners, say they're considering reducing charitable giving to make up for the additional expense. The new tax moves the state's top rate to nearly 10% and gives Minnesota the fourth highest income tax rate in the nation. The executive director of the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits, John Pratt, says he's not worried that charitable organizations in the state will lose support because of the income tax hike.
We do track charitable giving trends over time, and you know the corollary would be, oh, if you reduce taxes, do you see contributions go up dramatically? It's more, contributions seem to be tied more to the overall economy rather than to specific tax rates.
Critics of the new tax rate say it could push wealthy Minnesotans to change their residency to states with lower or no income taxes. However, studies show increasing income tax rates has not led to an exodus of top earners elsewhere. The Minnesota legislature has committed more than $100 million to the next phase of restoring Minnesota's state capitol building. The work will involve fixing damaged stone, replacing the roof, upgrading the plumbing, which was installed in 1905, and modernizing heating, cooling, and electrical systems. State Commissioner of Administration Spencer Kronk says everyone that works in the Capitol will have to move out at some point to accommodate the different phases of work on the building. But he says Minnesotans will still be able to interact with the legislative process.
We are committed to making sure that the work of the Capitol is still going on, that public still has access to their legislators, that they can still talk to them in offices. That said, it is a large-scale construction project, and there will be inconveniences. You'll see some of the lawn will be torn up, and parking might be challenging for a while. But we want to make sure that the functioning of state government still goes on.
And the work on this latest phase of the Capitol renovation is expected to take about 4 years. That's a regional news update. Now moving on to some international news. The government of Pakistan has responded to the new drone guidelines President Obama outlined yesterday during a speech at the National Defense University. Here's a reminder of what President Obama had to say.
America cannot take strikes wherever we choose. Our actions are bound by consultations with partners and respect for state sovereignty. America does not take strikes to punish individuals. We act against terrorists who pose a continuing and imminent threat to the American people. And when there are no other governments capable of effectively addressing the threat, and before any strike is taken, there must be near certainty that no civilians will be killed or injured, the highest standard we can set.
In a written response, the Pakistani government said the government of Pakistan has consistently maintained that the drone strikes are counterproductive until the loss of innocent civilian lives, have human rights and humanitarian implications, and violate the principles of national sovereignty, territorial integrity, and international law. The BBC's Julian Marshall asked the spokesperson for Pakistan's opposition PTI party, Shireen Mazari, if he thought the Pakistani government's response should have been tougher.
Yes, I do, because it's not a matter of whether the Americans consult the Pakistani government or not. We are very clear that drones are illegal according to international law, that they violate the sovereignty of Pakistan, and they're against human rights because they have been killing more innocent civilians than terrorists when they have taken place in Pakistan. So on all those counts, we have a very clear-cut policy of not accepting any form of drone attacks from the United States. And when Parliament convenes, the new Parliament, our party will take that up very strongly.
But it's one thing to be able to say such things in opposition, but you acknowledge, do you, that when you are in government, you have to be rather more pragmatic in your relations with foreign states?
I think pragmatism doesn't mean selling out the lives of your people for dollars. I think pragmatism requires that the government realize that drone attacks have created more polarization, have created greater violence and militancy in Pakistan, and they have produced not an iota of success in Pakistan's own fight against its problem of terrorism.
That was Shireen Mansari from Pakistan's opposition PTI party. Now over to Britain, where a parliamentary inquiry has been ordered after officials confirmed that two men arrested in the hacking death of the off-duty British soldier on Wednesday were both known to the British security service MI5. The BBC's Jackie Leonard asked their home affairs correspondent Dominic Cassiani how many other people in Britain might be a risk to homeland security.
It's very difficult to say. The best figures we have are from 2007, when the then head of MI5, which is Britain's internal security agency, said that there were maybe 2,000 people who were actively posing a threat to national security. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean they were all going to blow themselves up at that particular point in that year. The way it breaks down is that some of these people are talking about violence, considering it. Some of them are involved in active cells. They're in groups which are trying to formulate plans. But in any one given year, for the past decade, we've probably had one substantial possible attack on the size of the London suicide bombings of 2005. So you're probably talking up to maybe a dozen people in any one given year who pose a real threat. And those are the people who MI5 try to focus their resources on.
How do they find these people? How do the security services decide who is a potential threat, and what can they then do about it?
Well, there's very little we know about this, because if we knew all the secrets, then the guys they're chasing would get away. But the way it works is any intelligence investigation starts with a basic question: who is the person they're looking at? Now, they don't mean that in terms of, you know, who that person is, their name, their identity. What they're talking about is their character. You know, what is it about their life which makes them different? What is it that they believe in what they're doing? So an intelligence officer who has a lead on somebody who may be a threat starts considering the personal details, how they live their life, who they know, who they associate with, you know, where are they going, you know, what kind of media are they consuming, and how are they articulating their views. And slowly you start to build up a picture which poses more questions about that person's life. And you potentially get to a point where an intelligence officer can say, do you know what, this person has pretty extreme views, but they're not necessarily a threat. Or they say, this person is a threat. This is a person of, using their jargon, of interest, a person of interest. And those are the people they have to put the coverage on.
The BBC's Dominic Cassiani. You're listening to The Daily Circuit from NPR News.
I'm Tom Weber. I had a lot of fun earlier this week at the Fitzgerald Theater here in St. Paul for an event we called Science Night Minnesota. I got to speak about Mars and the Curiosity rover that's up there with John Grotzinger. He's the chief scientist for the Mars Science Laboratory. Remember that day last August when Curiosity successfully landed after a crazy involved process known as the 7 minutes of terror? Remember everyone's reaction?
Touchdown confirmed. We're safe on Mars.
Well, Grotzinger was in that room at that moment. I asked him if there was anything useful he could do while everyone was waiting to hear whether Curiosity had landed safely.
No, you basically sit back and bite your nails. You know, you could see in that room full of blue shirts in sequence, everybody is waiting to get back a tone from the spacecraft that tells that person that something critically important executed properly. But the, you know, because of the speed of light, it's at least 7 minutes delayed, 14 minutes in our case. So once the robot enters the upper atmosphere, it's guiding itself all the way to the ground. There's nothing you can do but sit back and hope to get good beeps.
So it had either crashed amazingly or landed safely, and you just had to wait and watch, like you'd watch the end of a movie, but you can't fast forward.
Yeah. You know, it was an amazing experience. We had practiced it several times, and when the real event came, you could just tell that it was for real, because every time one of those events triggered, you could see the person just go from being joyous to teary.
So the person who was in charge of that one little thing, you could see that person right
now.
Yeah,
you knew to watch them. Yeah.
So you have the capsule detached from the rocket, fall into the atmosphere. This massive parachute opens and detaches And then you have the sky crane. That detaches. There's booster rockets slowly bringing it down to Mars. And if it were the Olympics, even with a Romanian judge, you would have gotten a perfect 10 for that landing. But why did it even have to be so complex? Couldn't you just plop that sucker down on Mars? Yeah. I seem to recall years and years ago, they just threw it down and it had big airbags and it just bounced around for a few minutes till it landed.
Yeah. What could go wrong?
What could possibly go wrong?
We had that. We went through many reviews, and that team. They are all heroes, and every one of those steps was absolutely necessary for one reason or another. Just at the end, you know, we like to joke and call it rover on a rope when the sky crane is doing its thing, and that's because if the thrusters if we had built them onto the rover, the thrust is so intense it would have taken rocks. And they would have ricocheted up and hit the rover, and we might have damaged something. So you tend to weigh the risk of a complicated deployment versus the risk of damaging the rover, and you go back and forth, and then people come to agreement on what the wise thing is to do.
Adam Stetzner, who was in charge of this, one of your colleagues, he wrote in a New Yorker article that just came out about a week or so ago. He says it's almost creepy how well it went, the landing specifically. I almost wonder, you know, A, what was it? How is it that you got it to be that perfect 10? And then the second question is, does that mean we take the next one for granted, that the next one's going to be just as easy?
Yeah, we are worried that it looked so easy that you know, the next time your expectation is it will happen again. I mean, people have to remember this was something that was truly extraordinary, and I think the reason it went right is because we practiced and practiced and practiced. And so JPL has this sort of mantra. It's like in real estate, you talk about location, location, location. And for us, it's test as you fly and fly as you test. And you make no exceptions to that. And you don't build something that you can't test, and you don't fly something that you can't test, and you don't do something on Mars that you can't test. And so you do it over and over and over again until you've got it down with no margin for error.
So does that mean that some morning in the desert you actually launched a rocket and practiced that whole rigmarole here on Earth?
Yeah, that was really the part that I never quite got. Because you can't actually do the whole thing because Earth is different from Mars. It's got different gravity. It's a really complex system. The way in the end it's done, the way if you're going to build a new kind of a jet fighter, the prototype is actually built on a computer. So a lot of the testing was done on supercomputers. But a lot of the components that we did test on Earth out at Edwards Air Force Base, we'd hook up the radar to a Black Hawk helicopter and fly it around and try to spoof it and make sure that those components worked.
So here's a question I'm only asking because I just learned what the answer was a few days ago and I was interested by that. How many Curiosity rovers exist in the universe?
Well, there's sort of 2.5.
That is such a NASA answer.
I know the question's just more difficult as we go along here. We've got Curiosity, which is on Mars, and then we have a rover back on Earth. It is a NASA acronym. It's called VSTB, and that rover is very, very close facsimile of what flies on Mars. And we use it mostly to check out the capability, the science instruments, using the arm, using the mast, taking pictures, stuff like that. And then we've got a rover that's sort of our field test model, and we drive that around a facility at JPL called the Mars Yard. And it has a different mass than the other test rover does that sort of simulates being on Mars. So Mars is a less massive planet, so we have a less massive rover. And we test out all the mechanical capabilities. But it has none of the computers, so it's got all heart, no brain. We call it a scarecrow.
Also, I understand you've completely ruined your family life, just in general, but no, I'm just kidding. But because some of the scientists have decided to change their watches to be in sync with what time it is on Mars. Explain that.
Yeah, that was a problem. Mars has this, it rotates once every 24 hours and 39 minutes, which is really annoying. Because if it rotated once every 24 hours, we could just follow it around. So basically, the way we communicate with the rover is just after sunrise on Mars, we send it a command sequence directly from Earth, mm-hmm. and it tells the rover to wake up and do this, this, and that during the course of the day. And then shortly before sunset on Mars, it sends us a message back, and it tells us exactly what it did. And then we get that information. And then what we do is we work during the Mars night to process the data, think about what we've done, think about what we should have done, think about what we're probably going to do. And then the next day we send up the command sequence. And so we have to follow the Martian day. So when we first land, you know, you've got this thing and, you know, we want to practice with it. We don't want to make mistakes. So we want the most amount of time in a day to actually figure out what we want to do and make sure it's going to work. Mm-hmm. So you want the most time, which means you have to be attached to Mars. So every day you get up 39 minutes later, you have dinner 39 minutes later, you go to work 39 minutes later, you go home 39 minutes later. It's like getting in an airplane and driving two-thirds of a time zone every day and then doing it again. And then the next day you go again, and, you know, if we fly from here in a week, we're sort of halfway across the Pacific, then you wind up in China. You know, a month later you come back and your family sees you again, but the rest of the time you're sort of living like a vampire. So what we do is we sort of tend to stay up too late, or we mm-hmm. spend, you know, we try to meet. It's, you know, you go to the local restaurant that's open all night long, and so one group is coming in and you're they're having breakfast and you're having a steak and a beer.
It's a smart restaurant owner that they stay open all night. There's actually been some attention in recent weeks, actually more like a month or so ago, that we had a break, and some of the write-ups were that Curiosity was on spring break, that we weren't actually talking to it at all, that it was off, you know, at the beach or something. Why did we have to take a break from Curiosity? It just got up there.
Yeah, right. So that's because, you know, once every 2 years, Earth and Mars sort of, they go around the sun in their orbits, and Mars gets ahead of the Earth, and then it gets so far ahead that it's behind the sun relative to Earth, so we can't see it, and so it goes behind the sun, then we have no communication, and this year it lasted for 28 days, and you just keep your fingers crossed and hope at the end of that period Curiosity will still be with us.
28 days later, you had to find out.
You're waiting for beeps again.
And, of course, I call Curiosity a little guy there, but this Curiosity is not a little guy at all.
Yeah, it's
like an SUV.
The mast stands up. If you took the arm and you reached it up, you could dunk a basketball.
When is that going to happen? Hello? I'll set my alarm 39 minutes later. I want to know when that's happening. So we've gotten ourselves to Mars. Congratulations. Now I want to kind of transition here and talk a little bit about what you're doing up there, the actual science you're doing. And so this is always the interesting thing to say. When you're on Mars and the whole point of this mission is you're not looking for life, you're looking for proof that conditions might have been right once before so that life could have existed. Is that right?
Yeah, that's the complicated usual explanation. You know, we 10 years ago, we told the world we were looking for water on Mars. Let's land a rover and find evidence it's water, because all life as we know it has water in it. And where people would really like to go immediately is to swing for the fence and look for life on Mars. But, you know, that's hard to do. So in the middle, you've got to decide whether or not that water is good water. And so what we've got is a chemistry test that we could take a sample of the water and find out if it's the kind of thing that would actually really support life.
So if this were a glass of Martian water, Would I want to drink it, or would I just keel over having just have a sip?
You know, that was the fun thing that we were able to share with the world on March 12th was our major scientific discovery that we hadn't just found water again for the 1,000th time on Mars.
It's so boring to find water on Mars.
But it was the kind of water that you might have had a glass full of and been happy for it.
So what does that mean? If the water is drinkable, what's then the next conclusion that we can have from that?
Well, so what that means is it really paints a nice picture for the next decade. And we do these missions decade by decade. And it means now that we have found, represented by these ancient rocks billions of years ago, that there were once environments on Mars, that if life had evolved on Mars, this would have been the kind of place that we discovered where it could have existed. So you might want to grab some rocks and bring them back to Earth.
So then, when you found water again, but you're also actually drilling into rocks. Now, this is the first. This is your groundbreaking science on Mars. Talk about what you're doing there, where you're actually drilling into the ground.
Yeah, this is a huge step forward for us technologically, because before we were able to drive up to rocks and scrape them a little bit and look at them. But now what we've got is a drill. And it kind of works like the drill that you'd go pick up at Home Depot. It drills holes in concrete, but when you snap it that extra notch, it starts hammering. And so we put our drill down, and we go in to it about the depth of about an inch and a half, something like that. And then we take the powder, take the arm around, and then dump it into the rover.
So in the entire time you've been on Mars now, how far has Curiosity traveled in feet or yards or football fields?
Yeah. We've gone about 2 football fields, and it's been about 9 months. And what happened was, after we landed, we realized we had a hunch. And rather than drive to the mountain, which was something that we had been planning on doing.
Go west, young man.
Yeah, we went east instead.
Okay.
And nobody could figure out why. And we had told the media that we were going to drive to the mountain. And they said, what are you doing? You're going the opposite direction. And so, you know, we had to explain to them that we had this hunch, but they'd have to wait and be patient. And so eventually we drove down into this place where we drilled this hole in the rock based on the hunch, and it turned out that instead of getting red Mars, we got gray Mars. And that was really when we knew that we were on our way to a pretty good habitability story.
So what does that mean? We're not just a red planet anymore.
Right. So what you can look at, it's this kind of a cool picture, because you can see the hole that we drilled, and the powder, the rock is converted into powder, and then if you look up to the upper left, you can see the red planet. That's red Mars. It's red because there's iron in the dust and the soil. But the gray stuff tells us that there's iron in that rock, but it's in a different chemical state, and one that's much more promising for it having been a habitable environment, if there are ever microbes there.
And this is happening where? You have a name for this area of Mars?
Yeah, it's a place that we drove the rover downhill into sort of a little depression, and the team decided to call it Yellowknife Bay. And then, because this is the first hole that's ever been drilled on another planet, we named it after one of our lead engineers who passed away shortly before the mission, a fellow called John Klein. And so we dedicated the first hole on Mars in his memory.
And so you take the powder, you put it inside the belly, and then what happens? How can you tell? You have never held a Martian rock. How do you know what's in a Martian rock?
Yeah. Well, it's hard. You know, the problem is you have to, it's a little bit like baking a cake. What we do is, you know, we take the rock, we drill the hole into it, mm-hmm. we take the powder, we put it into the instrument in the rover, and it kind of works like an oven. And so what's happening is we start heating it up. We have that oven heats up, and it gets really, really hot, goes up to maybe 1,500 degrees centigrade. And as it's cooking away, just like you walk into the kitchen and you can tell there's a cake in the oven because you smell it. You can't see it. You don't know that there's a cake in there for sure, but you can smell the vapors coming off. And so we collect those gases, and then we analyze them, and that's what tells us what's in the rock.
And you found?
And we found a lot of interesting chemicals and minerals that would have been the kind of things that if simple microorganisms had been there, they would have been able to live off those.
So does that mean you've already accomplished the mission and that question that I just posed earlier?
Yeah, that was a nice thing for us to get in the bag pretty well on. It's a 2-year mission, and after 8 months we accomplished our goal just by going after that hunch.
So pack her up, bring her home. We're done.
No, it's there to stay.
So the question here, though, I think that when we go back, we've discovered water, but if we're still, you're looking for signs that maybe there was once life. Are you ever going to be able to find, for example, a fossil or proof that there actually was life? Or are you always going to have to kind of skirt around the edge of the question the way we are kind of with this mission?
Yeah. There's two really sort of concrete things we can do. And one of them is if you look in the scoop there, you can see that powder, and it has this grayish green color, and that's exciting for us, because if you go and you sample rocks that are billions of years old here on Earth, for example, if you go northern Minnesota, go up to the Mesabi Range, those iron ranges up there, they're made out of the kind of iron that's red, but you can also find rocks that are gray, and if you collect the gray rocks, every once in a while you can find materials that represent former microorganisms that lived on the Earth 1.8 billion years ago when those rocks up in northern Minnesota were being formed. So we can hopefully sample these gray rocks and look for organic compounds. So, for example, if we were to die, get buried.
Oh, John.
I know, it's an awful thing to think about. Come back in a few billion years, you know what's going to be left of us? Cholesterol.
These lab coats. cholesterol?
Cholesterol. When all is said and done, that's what's going to be left. So we can look for molecules like that on rocks that are billions of years old here on Earth and tell that there was once life here. So we can look for those kinds of molecules, but the thing we would really like to do is get the rocks into a rover and send them back to Earth, because we can do a much better job here.
This is Science Night Minnesota coming to you from the Fitzgerald Theater. I'm Tom Weber. It is time now for our science friend to join us. Maggie Kurth-Baker is the science editor at boingboing.net. She writes for New York Times Magazine and has recently published Before the Lights Go Out, a book about the future of energy. Hello, Maggie.
Hi, how are you guys?
Pull that a little closer there. I'm so glad you're here.
I'm so glad I could make it.
This is kind of a cool job because John gets to text Mars every day. but your job, I'd say, is a close second because you just basically get to geek out about science every day.
Yeah, no, it's pretty fantastic. I get to take all of the things that I would normally be procrastinating from a different job and actually turn it into real work that I get paid for. So yeah, it's pretty fantastic.
What I love, though, about your website, and if you've not been, I highly recommend it. Maggie's on there all the time. And there's a lot of interest and loyalty among your readers, especially on these science questions. So that's why we wanted to bring you here today, because I know that you've been... I'm curious, from your reader's perspective, what do people want to know about Mars exploration?
Well, I think one of the big things that they're concerned about is that Mars needs people. they really want to go to Mars. They want somebody to go to Mars. And one of the things that kept coming up a lot was this idea that, you know, we have the technology to get something to Mars. It's the getting back that's kind of the hard part. And as soon as that came up, of course, immediately there was this discussion about, well, what if we could just send people, and then they could live and die there, and we wouldn't have to bring them back?
Hooray! Everybody
and
wins.
Then, you know. And then, naturally, people started like, where can I sign up for this?
Yeah.
And that kind of makes me curious a little bit about, is that something NASA would ever even remotely consider, sending people to Mars and just leaving them there?
Go for it.
Well, you know, I think we all know a few people we'd like to send on that trip. I think, you know, NASA's probably going to be thinking about this. And, you know, they're sort of the regulatory authority for space engineering and science in the country. But this could pose an interesting challenge because it's, you know, there's some people that have the financial ability to sort of sponsor their own space missions now. It's a new era we're living in with the commercialization of space.
Does research on Mars happen in that kind of slower way more than other science does?
Research on Mars, it's probably, you know, in my experience, you know, working on Earth in remote locations, other than the fact that the rover, you know, is sort of the limiting step in terms of how fast you can go, your ability to think through the scenarios that might be ideas that you'd want to test out as hypotheses, that still goes along at the speed that everybody wants to think at. It's just that with a rover, you only get one of them. Mm-hmm. You have to go slow, and if it breaks, you don't get another one. And so you just don't want to make any mistakes. And so things that normally, you know, Curiosity's middle name is patience. We just go slowly because we don't want to make any mistakes.
And are there bits that the one rover can do better at than another? I mean, with the water thing, were there stuff that, what kinds of stuff could Spirit and Opportunity do that they couldn't or couldn't do that Curiosity can do now?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think if you have, you know, you had another way, if you look at the cost of our mission, you could have probably done two or three Spirit and Opportunities, and you could have sent them to other parts of Mars, and they would have told you about the ability of Mars to have water billions of years ago in even more places. And, you know, that would be terrific, and that would sort of broaden your understanding. But instead, we are kind of forced to put all our eggs in one basket and try to be bigger and better in one place with the hope that you can go deeper into the problem and understanding the early environmental evolution of Mars.
That is John Grotzinger, the chief scientist of the Mars Science Laboratory. They're taking questions from Maggie Kurth-Baker from BoingBoing.net, all part of an event earlier this week called Science Night Minnesota, a collaboration between Minnesota Public Radio, the Science Museum of Minnesota, and the Public Insight Network. We have photos from the event. We also have some video of the event, including John and I. Maybe we were wearing some NASA flight suits. I don't know. You'll just have to go online to nprnews.org and see what that's all about. We'll hear more from John Grotzinger in a few minutes after a check of the hour's news with Mark Sedeklik. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Tom. Investigators have determined the cause of last night's bridge collapse on an interstate highway over a river north of Seattle. They say a truck carrying an oversized load struck part of the bridge, sending a section of the span and two vehicles into the river. Three people in the two vehicles suffered only minor injuries. Drivers traveling between Seattle and Canada are being told to expect delays. Detours have been set up to try to ease the congestion. The trucking company says it received a state-issued permit to carry its oversized load across the bridge. Some labor unions that initially backed President Obama's health care overhaul now say they're frustrated and angry about some unexpected consequences. Leaders of several retail, construction, and trade unions say the new health care law is making their unique multi-employer plans more costly. They fear employers will abandon them to save the money. There are signs of improvement among airlines, hotels, and campgrounds as the unofficial start of the summer travel season begins this weekend. Still, many Americans are planning to stay closer to home because of the continued uneven economy. AAA says vehicle travel this weekend should be about the same as last year, but total travel may show a decline. Coming up today at 12 noon on NPR News presents a speech by historian David Blight, Race and Reunion, the Civil War in American Memory. Blight spoke at the Minnesota History Center. You can hear his remarks in about 22 minutes. More is just ahead of the Daily Circuit.
Subscribe to the NPR News Update, delivered to your inbox weekdays at 1. Catch up with the day's top stories or listen to the audio version on demand. The NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule.
Support for this program comes from the College of St. Scholastica's School of Education, hosting the third annual 21st Century Teaching and Learning Conference with keynote Jonathan Kozel, June 18th in Duluth. Go to css.edu/TL.
A lot happens between 9 and noon. The Daily Circuit on Minnesota Public Radio News.
I'm Tom Weber. Now back to my conversation from earlier this week at Science Night Minnesota. That's when I spoke at the Fitzgerald Theater with John Grotzinger. He leads the team that tells the Mars Curiosity rover where to go and what to do up there on Mars. I also asked him if anything that he has learned about the geology of Mars will help us understand Earth better.
The really cool thing for me about what we're doing with Curiosity is it's like a time machine. And when you see these pictures of these rocks, the rocks that you're seeing there are probably 3.5 billion years old, maybe 4 billion years old. The oldest rocks on Earth are just barely 4 billion years old, and there's little tiny specks of them here and there. The whole planet's made out of this stuff. So if you can get a sense for how the rocks, what ancient environments they represent, what we can do is fill in the gaps of our record that's missing here on Earth. It's been destroyed by plate tectonics, by this constant reshuffling of the continents over time. And Mars is like a planet in a state of suspended animation. Mm-hmm. So we can get back and we can look at these rocks and reconstruct ancient times that might have had to do with the origins of life on Earth. So even if we never find any evidence of life on Mars, we get a better glimpse of our own roots.
Stupid shifting continents. Come on. But why is it? Why can we draw that conclusion? What is it about Mars that allows us to say it's enough of an apples to apples comparison?
Yeah, Mars is a close relative. It's not like a sister or brother. It's probably like a cousin, mm-hmm. but it's close enough. You know, what we've gotten out of the last 20 or 30 years of exploring and now what Curiosity is teaching us is that these are remarkably similar kinds of places once upon a time. So, you know, this is the Yellowknife Bay mm-hmm. area over our shoulder where we drove the rover down into and drilled this hole, and everything that we see there looks so similar to Earth. 10 years ago, we got excited because it just looked weird. You know, it's a wow, Mars is weird. That's kind of the Star Trek, you know, feeling that you get. You know, you go where no man has gone before and sort of make something happen, and it looks weird, and it is weird. You know, now we're entering an age where we go into Mars and we know where to look for the places that were more similar to Earth. And when you realize that Earth only gets us so far with rocks that are, you know, 3.5 billion years old, we see the first signs of life, everybody wants to know, well, what happened? How did life get going on Earth? And here we have a chance to maybe fill that in a little bit.
Well, and so if it's a cousin, albeit a cousin we actually want to visit and hang out with, is there something about the concept here that, you know, at some point in its past, the Earth, something happened on Earth, and it blossomed and it breathed and it became this, you know, place that allows for human life, whereas Mars, I mean, in some ways, at some point, hit a moment where it just started, it would appear, suffocating on itself. Do we know why it happened on Earth, but it didn't happen on Mars?
We don't know that yet, and that's one of the cool things about going to the mountain that we're going to start driving to sometime later this year. And, you know, we basically get the chance to study, you know, what you might call the great desiccation event. You know, why did Mars go from a planet that looked so promising into the state that it's in today? That record, that event may be recorded. And just like you can go look in the Grand Canyon and get a sense for what was happening early on in the Earth, if we go to this mountain, we might be able to get a glimpse at that time when the record Earth was looking good and Mars was starting to look bad.
So this is Mount Sharp you're talking about.
Yeah, Mount Sharp we call it.
And it's going to take what, like 2 years to climb Mount Sharp?
Well, we're going to start out in the foothills, and that's where we see evidence, you know, from orbiters that are going around Mars. We can look down at the surface of the planet and get a sense that, you know, that's the place we want to look for. That's a good-looking place down there. But then when you get up about, 1,000 feet or so, 2,000 feet, something like that, you start climbing up there, and the rocks change their character from orbit. And instead of seeing what might have been wet Mars, you start to see evidence of dry Mars. So we don't know if we're going to drive to the top, but we're definitely going to drive through that transition at some point.
How does SUV basketball dunking Curiosity climb a mountain or ford a stream?
Yeah, like my grandfather.
Yeah, like your grandfather.
it's big and it can dunk a basketball, but it only goes one football field a day on a good day.
So, I mean, I'm thinking, you know, you can go across a fairly flat surface pretty easy, but I, you know, despite the TV commercials, I don't want to drive an SUV up the side of a mountain if it's that rocky and jagged? I mean, how does it have things it can latch onto and be like a mountain climber?
Yeah, it's surprising, actually. It's a capable field vehicle. We take it out into the Mars yard and you know, take the Scarecrow out there and torture it. You know, you really want to see what it can do, and it does at least as good as a four-wheel drive car. So, you know, we think we're going to be able to just sort of creep our way up there, which is what we want to do. We don't want to just drive to the top without stopping to smell the roses. So, you know, along the way we're gonna stop and drill holes and make measurements and do science and all that kind of stuff. And so, you know, it's what we need to get the job done.
I mean, in the most simplest, crudest way, is it possible you'll get to a point where you've done something and the thing just falls off the mountain? I mean, I have no idea.
Well, so have faith. The engineers do not let scientists drive the rover.
That, though, I mean, the bigger what-ifs that we have as a wider public involve things like whether you would send a human to Mars, and we talked a little bit about that with Maggie. I mean, are you saying then that the science we're going to get if we just keep sending rovers is going to be way better than trying to figure out all the things that have to figure out to send a human? Would that be your opinion?
Well, you know, you never get the efficiency from a robot that you get from a human. I mean, if you could put a human on Mars, it's not going to have to wait to take pictures to see how safe the terrain is. The human astronaut's just going to walk right up there and collect the rocks, put them in the rucksack, bring them back to the launch vehicle, and send them back to Earth, just like Apollo did. And so, you know, we feel that many things that we do scientifically, if you have enough time, you can get to it. But, you know, what might take 2 years on Mars could be done in 2 days by an astronaut. Mm-hmm.
Even if we don't, frankly, get humans to Mars, why is it so romantic? Why is it this thing that when people are asked, would you go to Mars and never come back, a lot of people say yes? What's going on?
You know, I think that it's out there. And we haven't done it. And you know, one of the things that humans are great about is taking on those kinds of challenges. And I don't think you have to have a compelling science reason to want to go to Mars as a human being. If you just wanted to do science, we can learn a lot of stuff with rovers and other kinds of robots. But at the end of the day, you know, it's the human experience for having had that challenge and doing it, and it's just up to us as a country and as a, you know, as an assemblage of countries that are interested in space exploration to do it.
Although as a geologist, you're probably kind of at your height right now with what's happening there with the research as well.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind if they brought some rocks back.
That's John Grotzinger, chief scientist of the Mars Science Laboratory, a.k.a. the Curiosity rover. He was speaking at an event we had earlier this week called Science Night Minnesota. Members of APM's Public Insight Network were in the audience as well, along with students from some Twin Cities schools. And the science editor of BoingBoing.net, Maggie Kurth Baker, she was out in the audience seeking questions. And here's one from a Public Insight Network source, David Linton of Minneapolis.
Hi. Basically, my question has to do with the fact that most of what we're hearing in the news, most of the focus in conversations about Mars exploration right now seems to be focusing on life on Mars, either whether it was suitable for ancient life native to Mars or whether it's someday going to be a place we could colonize. And my question is, what other sorts of things are we learning or are we going to learn through our explorations that maybe we haven't been paying enough attention to and that we really should be watching out for?
Thanks for the question. Good question. Yeah.
I think that it's a great question. When you interact with the media in the context of the mission, it's the question that comes up all the time, which is, you know, are you guys looking for life? No, we're not. We don't have the ability to detect life. That's a different kind of a mission. We call it a life detection mission. Well, when are you guys going to start looking for life? Well, you know, we got to first discover if there's habitable environments. It goes on and on and on. And what you really want to talk about is what you learn while you're addressing the question of whether or not there's life there. And that's where That's where I like to talk about this business of comparative planetary evolution. I mean, we're all interested in our past. We're all interested in roots. We are historians and take history classes in college, and there's just something really interesting about understanding your past. And the great thing about Mars, unlike any other planet in the solar system, it uniquely contains a geological record which tells us about what could have Earth could have looked like 3.5 to 4 billion years ago when we have such a poor record here on Earth. It's like the missing tape. We just have to go get it.
Next question then, Maggie.
The next question that we have is from one of the Farnsworth Aerospace pre-K through 8 magnet school students. Mm-hmm. She's not here tonight, but her name is Kalia. And she has one of those visiting Mars questions, but it's specifically for you. She wants to know that if you had a chance to go to Mars, what would be the first thing that you would do?
Well, the first thing I would do is ask if they're going to take me back.
Just send.
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah,
then you would dunk a basketball.
Yeah, so, you know, I think what I would want to do is I'd want to walk to the top of Mount Sharp.
Fantastic. Our third question is from Furry School, who's a person on Twitter. And he is wondering what the chances of us actually being able to terraform Mars and turn it into something more like Earth. Can we reverse those processes that you were talking about earlier?
Can we build a strip mall, John? That's what I want to know.
You know, the possibilities are boundless. The interesting thing about that question is it's just an opportunity to educate the audience. Is that before you can do that, you got to get beyond planetary protection, and that's the organization in NASA that makes sure that when we send a spacecraft up to Mars, it's as clean as it can be, so that we don't actually colonize Mars. I mean, we're looking for life on Mars. Wouldn't it be a shame if we get up there and find it and it actually came from Earth, the previous mission?
You're talking about like us bringing our own bacteria and things like that. And then we cough or throw up on Mars, and and then we've messed up everything. Then we've messed up another planet.
Tom Merritt from White Bear Lake has a question.
Dr. Gretzinger, I was intrigued over the recent years to hear reports of finding on Earth some rocks that came from Mars. And I wondered, in your opinion, is it possible there are rocks on Mars that came from Earth? And if so, if Curiosity encountered one, what's the problem, or could Curiosity even identify it?
That's a great question. If we found certain types of rocks that have the composition that Earth has on average for the continents, we'd probably stop and really think about it. It's entirely possible that could happen. You'd have meteorites, chunks of Earth that got ejected and are now sitting on the surface of Mars. Some cases it would be hard to tell the difference.
How would chunks of Earth get jettisoned from Earth? I never caught that on the news.
Yeah. It's not a topic of popular conversation. But it would be like, you know, everybody's heard about the dinosaurs going extinct, and you have this gigantic impact that happened in Mexico. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if a chunk of that rock actually, if the energy of the impact was high enough, it could fling a piece of that rock. Now it's out in space orbiting around. It could eventually land on Mars.
Another question, Maggie?
Carrie from Farnsworth Aerospace Magnet School.
Hi, so my question is, are there any new rovers being developed for Mars? If so, how would they be different from the last three?
Well, NASA, after our successful landing, and it looked like Curiosity was in good health, they announced that they were going to develop a new rover that should be launched in 2020. And we're still waiting to find out. It should be released, I would guess, probably end of June, maybe July. There will be a public statement about what the capabilities of that rover would be. I think many of us are hoping that it will be the start of sample return, and that rover would land, and where we drill samples and analyze them, this one would collect rocks and store them so that a later rover could come and retrieve them and eventually send them back to Earth.
So this next one wouldn't necessarily be the one to then come home. It would have to be something down the road to go get it?
Right, yeah. It's an important technology because, you know, for science to go to the next level, one option is to return rocks to Earth because we can just analyze them a lot better here. But for the human exploration part, it's absolutely necessary to figure out how to return something, unless you've got these people on the one-way trip.
But, right.
You know, for everybody else, you got to figure out where for Apollo, you know, moon is hardly has any mass. So you just give it a kick, and the LEM goes back up to the orbiter. And in the case of Mars, you know, there's real gravity there. So you have to figure out how to actually land something that can then lift off and escape the gravitational pull of Mars. That's hard.
Another question, Maggie.
From Twitter, Glade Wolstenholm wants to know that if there are mechanical errors on Curiosity, what can Curiosity itself do with the tools that it has on board to fix itself?
Oh, boy, don't we wish.
Uh-oh.
You know, it does not have self-generating capability. To give you an example of something that happened, you know, we do keep track of the errors that happen on Curiosity, human errors that we make that we can recover from. And then we discover eventually that there are mechanical capabilities that are not 100% what they thought they were going to be. We keep track of those. And it sort of tells us how the rover is aging through time, how long it might last for. And, you know, before this period of time when Mars went behind the sun, back in March, we had quite a scare when one of the computers, the rover has two computers, and one of the computers suffered a problem with its flash memory. That USB that we all stick in and out of our computers, it's kind of like that kind of memory. And we had a real issue with that, and we figured out where the problem is, and we know how to read and write and avoid that part of the memory, but we have no way to fix it. So that's part of the degradation of the rover.
So there's no HAL on board to self-correct everything. It's done.
Not happening.
We have a question from an eighth grader at Oakland Junior High School in Lake Elmo who wants to know, what is the coolest thing you have ever done while on the job?
I would say off the job, too, but, you know, whatever.
Well, there's a few people here that can answer that question. You know, on the job, I think, you know, there's a couple of things. There is one thing that stands out, and it's the night that you land, and you look at all the engineers that have taken 8 years of their life to build the spacecraft and to make sure that it works properly and to land it on the ground. And then as far as your job goes, you realize the moment that it lands that they shortly thereafter hand the keys over to you. And with that, you are entrusted what I consider to be a priceless national asset. You know, this is not, we don't know if we're ever going to do this again. We never know if it's going to be the last time. And we would like for this rover to be around for the kids in the first row here to be able to drive around in 10 or 20 years. So, you know, you feel this sense of responsibility, not just for the science, but to also have the mission last as long as it can.
That is John Grotzinger, the chief scientist of the Mars Science Laboratory. He was with me along with Maggie Kurth-Baker from boingboing.net. We had a capacity crowd this week at the Fitzgerald Theater in St. Paul for our first ever Science Night Minnesota. You can see photos from the event and video. There's also a video of, yes, John and me. We're in flight suits. There's a smoke machine. It's all there at nprnews.org. On Monday, Memorial Day, tune into the Best of the Daily Circuit. You'll hear Carrie's conversation with journalist Lawrence Wright about his book on Scientology. You'll also hear my conversation with Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Tracy Smith and more. Also, take note, next week, Carrie's in New York. She's attending the World Science Festival there in New York, and we're going to broadcast a number of her conversations that she's having out there as well. Hey, did you hear Dan Crocker's story this morning on cabins? The cabin season starts this weekend for a lot of people with the Memorial Day weekend. Well, we are collecting cabin photos, so share your images and memories on Twitter. When you do so, use the hashtag TellMPR. I'm also on Twitter at WeberTom1. You can follow the Daily Circuit at
Daily Circuit. This is the Daily Circuit. Hey, it's John Moe. Just a few live shows left in our spring season of Wits. Friday, June 7th, comedian Hannibal Buress with rapper Open Mike Eagle, plus two songs from POS. Also, Friday, May 31st, we've got actor Colin Hanks. Remember when he sang this on Mad Men?
Help me find the way to the promised land.
Plus music from Jason Isbell, formerly of Drive-By Truckers.
And I can't get to sleep at night. The parking lot's so loud.
And a special appearance by Harmar Superstar. Tickets at witsradio.org.
Programming is supported by Wells Fargo, working with the Neighborhood Development Center to help provide small business training. Details on Wells Fargo's small business community work online at wellsfargo.com/commitment. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
This is Minnesota Public Radio News, 91.1 KNOW, Minneapolis and St. Paul. You can listen live. You get free mobile apps available for download. You can get them for Android and for iPhone. Right now, 62 degrees, mostly sunny. What a day here in St.